When you study the history, the current history of the Lord's church, you find that in the last 120 to 130 years, there have been certain issues that have divided the missionary society and instrumental music, divided the Lord's church, and from that division came the Christian church. More recently, perhaps 60 years ago, the church was again divided, even though the division did not produce two separate names. But the division did cause two certain and very definite attitudes toward the use of the treasury. We call that division institutionalism. We've studied that. During the 1950s and the early 1960s, about 90 to 92% of the churches of Christ adopted a belief that the Lord's treasury could be used in a way that those of us who are identified as non-institutional think is without authority. So when you go into an area like the metropolitan Phoenix, 9 out of every 10 churches of Christ are those that believe in the support of colleges and orphans' homes and bus ministries and senior citizens' facilities and those kinds of things supported by the church. So you would find in the Metroplex of Phoenix maybe 7 religious bodies called the Church of Christ that don't believe that, of which Monte Vista is one. About 40 years ago, an issue arose that made further divisions within the non-institutional churches of Christ. And there was more than just one issue, but the main issue that caused factions was over the subject of divorce and remarriage. There were others, such as the Crossroads movement that began at the Crossroads Congregation of the Lord's Church in Gainesville, Florida, and they took a certain number of people into that which is now called the Boston Church. But that was not as significant nor as widespread, even though that did touch Monte Vista, because the preacher at Monte Vista went to that movement, and the preacher at Mesa went to that movement. So it was widely discussed within the Phoenix area. It did not have as far-reaching consequence on the body of Christ in, say, the United States as the issue of divorce and remarriage. There were other smaller movements that touched Monte Vista, such as the 80-70 doctrine. The 80-70 doctrine is that which was taught by Eddie Mercado, who was a member at this congregation and was withdrawn from, and his wife now attends Valley and does not share that belief. That 80-70 doctrine was a cause of some splits of congregations in the area of Ohio that Glenn is familiar with. But that was not far-reaching from a standpoint of nationwide, not as far-reaching as divorce and remarriage. When I began preaching in 1983, I think it was, I began with the Long Beach Church of Christ, the Spring and Delta Congregation of the Church of Christ in Long Beach, California. And it was during that period of time that the debates were raging over divorce and remarriage. And there's some scriptural education that we need to keep current with regard to divorce and remarriage, because even though the debates are not raging like they were during the 70s and 80s and 90s, divorce and remarriage is still such a problem within our society that the elders of this church and other churches have a great responsibility to know the marital disposition of those members that want to place membership, and not only that, how they stand on these issues if they're going to be involved in the teaching program within this congregation. So even though I don't sit in the meetings that the elders hold with prospective members, I believe that they query the potential members concerning divorce and remarriage and their position on that, and lead the conversation open to the point where a belief on that subject could be aired by someone that might be in conflict with what the Bible teaches. Every time that I start thinking about what am I going to preach on Sunday, it becomes more of a thought process than it seems like it was the last time. Now I don't fool myself into thinking that you can remember what I preach more than 10 minutes after you get out the door. I understand that. But you remember the illustrations if they're good ones. And it seems to me that from time to time I just need to tell you what my modus operandi is. On Sunday morning, I try to preach those kinds of sermons that are motivational to the membership and informational and interesting to the visitors, in hopes that the visitors will return and visit again. That's my objective. On Sunday evenings, I try to deal with doctrinal issues for a couple of reasons. One, we need to know the history of institutionalism so that it doesn't happen again, don't we? We need to know why about the division over instrumental music so that it doesn't happen again, right? We need to know that. And usually speaking, there's more of a hardcore attendance on Sunday evening than there is on Sunday morning. The fluff is gone. I didn't mean no disrespect by the word fluff, but there are a lot of people that just are on the periphery, aren't they, of the church, and they show up on Sunday morning and then they're gone. And the people that really get involved in dealing with the issues are usually the people that are not only here on Sunday morning, but are here on Sunday night. And I'm not saying that everybody needs to think that way, but that's the way I think, and I'm the preacher here. So that's instrumental in determining, in my mind, what to deal with. Then you have to start thinking, how often do you preach about institutionalism? Well, you can't do it every week. So I try to ask people that know about teaching things. So I asked the head of the education department at Arizona State, how often would you recommend with a congregation that's sort of in a turnover mode all of the time, how often would you preach doctrinal things, nitty-gritty kind of things? And he said, I'd do it every 3 or 4 years. So that's what I do. So the lessons that we just heard on institutionalism, you hadn't heard, even though you probably thought you'd heard it sooner, you hadn't heard it for 3 or 4 years, and you haven't heard a sermon on divorce and remarriage for 3 or 4 years, but we need to understand the subject. I don't have any particular person in mind by preaching this, or any events that are current in mind in preaching this. We just need to stay current on the basics of these kinds of things so that we don't fall into the same traps that Satan lays before us, that we've fallen into as a church, not as a congregation, but as a church before, and let them divide us. That being said, what does the Bible have to say? I'm not focusing on divorce, but on divorce and remarriage. That's two different subjects. What does the Bible have to say? Let's begin with 1 Corinthians 14 and verse 33. This gives us information concerning the attitude of God, not just on divorce and remarriage, but on everything, on existence. Paul wrote, "For God is not the author of confusion, but of peace, as in all the churches of the saints." So God is a God that hates confusion and division in the church. And we know from Revelation 3 and verse 19 that the church is identified as the bride of Christ. So an analogy is made by inspiration as to a marriage between the church and God. The church is His bride, and God does not like confusion in that relationship. He likes that to be a peaceful and a productive relationship. God's will is for unity in marriage. And by marriage, I'm not talking about the analogy made between the congregation and God. I'm talking about a marriage such as Dale and Pam had. God's desire for the relationship that Judy and I have, called a marriage, is for unity. Jesus said, and if you wanted to say that there is a text, a basic text for this study, it's Mark the 10th chapter, verse 7, 8, and 9. Jesus said, "For this cause shall a man leave his father and mother, and shall cleave to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh, so that they are no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God hath joined together, let not man put asunder." That's basic information from a source that loves peace and unity in marriage with regard to how he would view this relationship, this oneness, this togetherness. Not only did God ordain marriage, and he did, he did that in the Garden of Eden, Genesis the 2nd chapter and verse 24. But God, even in old times, protected the sanctity of the marriage relationship. In the Ten Commandments, commandment number 7 and commandment number 10, read in Exodus the 20th chapter, verse 14 and 17, are broken when marriage is disregarded, when the sanctity of marriage is disregarded. "Thou shalt not commit adultery." Adultery is that illegal sexual relationship that's performed by marriage partners. The other, "Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife." That doesn't, The word neighbor there does not isolate it to the person who lives next door to you. That's saying you shall not covet someone else's wife. So two of the Ten Commandments, the very foundation of written law between God and man, are violated when divorce and remarriage occur. To further understand what God feels about marriage, one should go to the writings of the prophet Malachi. In Malachi, the second chapter, verse 15 and 16, God clearly states through that prophet his attitude toward divorce. That passage reads as this: "And did not he make one?" Stop right there. Let your mind go back to Mark, where it says, "You shall leave your father and mother and cleave to your husband and wife, and the two shall become what? One." All right? "And did not he make one? Yet he had the residue of the Spirit, and wherefore one? That he might seek a godly seed. Therefore, take heed to your spirit, and let none deal treacherously with the wife of his youth. For the Lord, the God of Israel, saith, he hateth putting away." I want you, for the purpose of our lesson, for the purpose of this series of study, to highlight in your mind the words, "he hateth putting away." That's a basic statement of God's feeling toward the breaking up of the oneness of marriage. He hates that. "For one covereth violence with his garment, saith the Lord of hosts. Therefore take heed to your spirit that you deal not treacherously." Any departure from God's plan of unity in marriage is allowed only under the most extreme circumstances. Only in the cases of sexual infidelity can one divorce a mate and remarry another. That's the law. Only in cases of sexual infidelity can a mate divorce and remarry another. You can take all of the circumstances and boil them down to the question: did that marriage break up because of sexual infidelity? And if it didn't, then regardless of any hardship statement, circumstance, societal decision, regardless of any of that, remarriage is unlawful. Period. We make this rocket science, and it's not. We play on emotion because we cloud the facts with circumstance, and indeed, there are a myriad of circumstances that touch the heartstrings. But unless a marriage is broken up by sexual infidelity, there can be no remarriage. And the passage for that we have just seen, or will see, in Matthew 5 and verse 32. "Everyone that putteth away his wife, saving for the cause of fornication, maketh her an adulteress, and whoso ever shall marry her when she is put away, committeth adultery." Now, with that in mind, as a basis, let me share with you what we are facing in our society. These are the most up-to-date statistics that have been taken by the Bureau of Vital Statistics of our government. 40 to 50% of the first time marriages end in divorce. That's where both parties have not been married before. They marry, 45 to 50% end in divorce. That's one out of every two. For those who have one or both partners In a second marriage, 60 to 67% end in a divorce. For those that have one or more members that are in the third or more marriages, 70 to 73% end in a divorce. You know what that's called when those kinds of statistics are related to disease? It's called a plague. That's what it's called by definition. Marriage within the society of the United States of America is facing a plague. And God deals with that in the passages that we will see. In the non-institutional churches of Christ, and I'm going to confine my comments to that because that's what we are. And that's what I'm familiar with and what I have debated and what I keep current on. So I'm not saying that there aren't more than three false doctrines in the non-institutional churches of Christ, but I tell you that there are three main false doctrines in the body, in the non-institutional churches of Christ, with which we need to be familiar and we need to study. The first two are this. One, that people outside the church are not subject to Christ's laws on marriage and divorce. If you're not a Christian, then the laws that we will go to that have been issued by Jesus Christ don't apply to you. They just apply to Christians. Number two, and it connects with number one because mainly the same icons of public speaking and preaching that teach one or write about one, write about both of them. Two is that baptism forgives adultery and sanctifies the adulterous relationship at the time of baptism. Joe and Jane are living in adultery, and Joe and Jane become baptized, and now Joe and Jane are not living in adultery. Now those things are written about, taught from the pulpit, and there are congregations that believe those doctrines, mainly because Homer Haley taught that. Homer Haley had great influence in the Church of Christ because of his association with Florida College. I'm not saying anything negative about Florida College. I'm saying that Homer Haley had great influence over preachers in the non-institutional Church of Christ because of his relationship with them that was developed at Florida College. And he was an easy person to like and to respect. His work on Isaiah and his work on the book of Revelation and his work on the books of the minor prophets in commentary form are brilliant, in my opinion. But he was wrong about divorce and remarriage. Also, W.L. Wharton. W.L. Wharton was a force of the preaching in the state of Texas, and he taught those false doctrines. L.A. Mott was a force of the preaching of the gospel in the southern United States, and he taught those false doctrines. Now, I know that some of those have passed away, but their influence remains with regard to those that followed them when they were alive and those that read and believe the things that they taught. Their influence is still among us. Don Givens taught that in the western part of the country. Samuel Dawson taught that in California, in sort of the lower northern part of California. So those are the people that were very vocal, very involved in debating and writing and discussing and arguing those issues. And all of those people, I know from personal experience, believe that people outside the church are not subject to Christ's law on marriage and divorce, and believe that baptism forgives adultery and sanctifies an adulterous relationship at the time of baptism. I know that not because I heard it, not because I read it, because I've talked to every single one of those people about it. Harold Dowdy was instrumental in teaching that in the state of Arkansas. The other of the three main false doctrines is that in the case of divorce for fornication, both parties have the right to remarry. They say that if the relationship is split, then neither person is bound by the relationship, and either person has the right to remarry. Now, the people that I talked to you about that believe the first two, I don't think believe this one. But I'll tell you that Lowell Williams does. And Lowell Williams is a force of teaching preachers and sending them out from Seattle, Washington. And they're all over the northwestern United States. Jerry Bassett preaches that. I debated him on the subject. Jerry Bassett filled the state of Oregon with that teaching. And they still have problems with the teaching of Jerry Bassett on divorce and remarriage in the state of Oregon. Now, Jerry's brother Don Bassett was a preacher in Nashville, Tennessee. And for a long time, he wouldn't say whether he agreed with Jerry or not, but Jerry had a debate one time, and Don was his second, and at that point he exposed what he believed on the subject, and he believed just what Jerry does. He's no longer preaching in Nashville, Tennessee, I think, but he believes that in the case of divorce for fornication, both parties have the right to remarry. I asked him about that in Bowling Green, Kentucky, at one of the congregations, the congregation where Buchanan is the preacher, Bob Buchanan. They used to, and I don't know if they still do, but they used to, once every year, they had a session on Saturday where they invited everybody, and like 500 people would show up, and they would write their questions down on a piece of paper, and there was a panel of four gospel preachers that sat up front, and I was in that twice, and they would just bring the paper, and you'd open it up, and you'd take your turn standing up and answer the questions. And one of the times, I was on that panel with Don Bassett. So I had opportunity to hear Don respond to questions on divorce and remarriage, and I had opportunity to talk to him specifically about this question that's on the screen before you. And I will guarantee you that Don Bassett believes what I say that he believes, because I ask him unless he's repented of that. Glenn Lovelace is a preacher in the Los Angeles area, and he taught that. I don't know how successful Glenn was, because Glenn had some other things that kept his influence from being of what it could have been. But he taught that at the same time that I was preaching for the Spring and Delta congregation in Long Beach. Now his brother, Dale Lovelady, was not a preacher, but he was an elder of the Maryville congregation in Phoenix, Arizona, and he believed that. And if you want to think that a preacher has influence, just let it become in an eldership and you learn what influence will do. And he believed that. And those people, and there may be some here tonight that went to the Maryville congregation, when it came down to answering situations that had to do with divorce for fornication, being the guilty party, and they went to Dale, they got a wrong answer. So it did. Its tentacles did reach into the Phoenix area. How should we deal with these people? Well, it's not a popular subject to broach. How do you deal with these people? Because these people are well known and they do good works. But I would suggest to you that when a person stands before you and teaches a false doctrine, he should be dealt with like a false teacher. Because that's what he is. The Bible is very specific with regard to how we deal with false teachers. I ask you, if you would, to look in your Bible at 2 Peter, the first chapter, verses 1 and 2, or 12 and 13. There the Bible says, "For this reason, I will not be negligent to remind you always of these things, though you know and are established in the present truth. Yes, I think it's right, as long as I am in this tent, to stir you up by reminding you." That's the purpose of these lessons. Now, in the same book, the next chapter, verse 1 through 3, "But there were also false prophets among the people, even as there will be false teachers among you." Will be is a current situation. That's present tense. "There will be false teachers among you, who will secretly bring in destructive heresies, even denying the Lord who brought them, and bring on themselves swift destruction. And many will follow their destructive ways, because of whom the way of truth will be blasphemed. By covetousness they will exploit you with deceptive words. For a long time their judgment has not been idle, and their destruction does not slumber." Now Romans 16 and verse 17 says, "Now I urge you, brethren, note those that cause divisions and offenses, contrary to the doctrine which you learned, and avoid them." We've noted them, we've put their names on the screen, and as much as we can and have opportunity, we should be careful of our association with them and the things they teach, because they're false teachers. And that's what avoid them means. And the reason that we should do that is Romans 16 and verse 17. If you and I presuppose not to do that, we violate in ourselves Colossians 3 and verse 17, that says that we should have authority in all that we say or do. And when we take it upon ourselves to avoid the avoiding of those false teachers, we break the law. And we place ourselves in jeopardy. It is not individual choice. It is legislated by God how we should conduct ourselves around false teachers. Well, that's probably the longest introduction in the history of man. But we need to know the seriousness of what we're going to be studying here for a few Sunday nights, so that we can, the best we can, remove the emotion from these subjects and see what the Bible has to say about them. And let the Bible be directive to our belief. We don't go to the Bible to prove a belief. We go to the Bible to establish a belief. So if in our study together we go to the scripture and we see something different than what we've believed, then the answer to us is, after we ascertain that indeed the Bible teaches that, the directive to us is to change our belief. That's what we demand of others with whom we study the Bible, and we should demand that of ourselves. Let's be careful not only to be firm on what we believe, but to believe the truth to be firm on. Because to be firm on error carries with it no justification. One other thing. I think that it probably would be better if I wasn't as emotional on this subject as I am. And I'm not hitting the pulpit yet, even though I used to. I stopped hitting the pulpit in Indiana one time where I had that ring on that I have, and I hit the pulpit during this sermon and it broke my finger. And I decided I'm not going to hit the pulpit anymore. Please don't take the fact that I am emotional on this subject as meaning that I'm not mad at anybody. I think that this subject is important to our soul salvation, don't you? And if I become too animated and you think, well, he's just got an axe to grind, well then, if you'll mention it to me, I'll try to simmer down a little bit and you try to simmer up a little bit and we'll reach an agreement that we need to study this and understand that it's important. It's important to be a Christian.